Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. Hope you guys are doing great today. And you know what? Today I'm so excited because we are finally speaking about a topic that I'm waiting for such a long time to get someone who is swimming in this topic. And we spoke about it several times, but for a long time, I didn't have someone professional in this sector. And I'm talking about hospitality. Evan Weiss, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ishai. Really appreciate it.
No problem. You guys, we have so much to talk about today. And Evan is a COO of LW Hospitality Advisors, as well as many other things which we'll talk about that he does, and very, very interesting stuff. But you know what? Before we start digging into your story, Evan, give us, you know, the 2-minute elevator pitch of what you guys do today, and, you know, we'll take it from there.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ishai. So LW Hospitality Advisors, the way to best describe our firm is that we're essentially a real estate services company, but focused exclusively and solely on the hospitality spaces. All we do is hospitality and gaming. Our company has done work in all 50 states, Canada, Puerto Rico, Caribbean, Mexico, a little bit of work in the UK as well. We're actually coming up on our 11th year anniversary. We're about 40 people coast to coast. And we have offices and or employees everywhere from San Diego to Austin, Dallas and Texas, Cleveland, Minneapolis, North Carolina, Florida, Massachusetts, DC area, Georgia, and of course, based in New York City. We have 3 verticals in our business. Vertical one is valuation. We do appraisals, feasibility studies, market studies, litigation support, expert testimony. Vertical 2 is third-party asset management. So we do true third-party asset management. We do a lot of consulting, advisory, help folks with due diligence, underwriting, help folks find brands and management companies and negotiate those agreements, as well as receiverships. And we have a third platform called LARC, Lodging Analytics Research and Consulting, LARC. We have a partner in that. I'm a co-founder of LWHA and a co-founder of LARC as well. And LARC basically is a data analytics provider. We look at the top 25 markets plus about 20 to 25 secondary markets. And we provide quarterly subscription-based data reporting, both historical information, current event information in those markets, as well as predictive analytics and things like average rate, occupancy, RevPAR, EBITDA, cap rates, and things of that nature. So it's really sort of a full-service, comprehensive hospitality and gaming advisory platform.
Which is amazing because you guys sound like you guys are focused completely on that, which leads me to the juice. How did you get into this whole thing? Meaning from the very beginning, real estate, especially hospitality, what got you into it?
That's a good question. So I'm really a hotel guy through and through. When I was in 10th grade in high school, my biology professor asked me, what do you want to do when you grow up? Actually, 9th grade. And I said, I want to be a hotel owner. I had no inclination as to what in the world that meant. I have no family in the business. And so I just kind of pursued it from there. And when I was applying to colleges, I applied to hotel schools at New York and BU and of course, Baruch in New York, as a fallback business school. And I was fortunate enough to get into NYU and BU, went to NYU's hotel school. And from there really developed, you know, a true passion and understanding of the business, and worked in catering, worked in, sales and marketing representation for hospitality while I was in school, worked in food and beverage. And then sort of began our career. And then I joined my current partner at CBRE in 2006. We worked together for about 5 years. And I started learning the business of hotels alongside the hotel business, sort of the real estate and the finance and the capital market side of things. And after 5 years at CBRE in their valuation advisory services group, we started LW Hospitality Advisors in Jan of 2011. So we're approaching 11 years now, thank God.
You know what, I always tell people that, you know, when you talk about hospitality, you're talking about two layers of business. First of all, the hotel business itself, obviously, and then the real estate, which is coming right on bottom. But you have to know both, and you can't go into acquiring land and to build a hotel or acquiring a hotel, whatever, without understanding the management aspect of it, which is beautiful because that's how your career is based, according to what you just told me, which is which is phenomenal. Tell me something. You guys, meaning you yourself with across, meaning whatever you've done throughout your career and you're still doing, you're dealing with different types of, you know, meaning within the hotel hospitality sector, different type of stuff. And always, it's always fascinating to break it down to so many types of hotels and in the hospitality sector. So if you could, you know, break it down for us a little bit so we can understand a little bit the business aspect of each and every one. And later on, we're going to start digging into to how the market is being, you know, affected by each and every one of them.
Absolutely. Thank you, Shai. So it's interesting. I often joke that I try to make the hotel business sound as complicated as possible so that people hire us. And you can't understand it. It's way above your pay grade. No, I do want to come back to a point you just made a moment ago. That's something we often say is that the hotel, that, you know, sort of the valuation of hotels is the bricks and mortar real estate intertwined with a 24/7, 365 operating business. So it is sort of the complexity of real estate in general, and then the operating business of hotels. Many often call it an operating business, but it really is both. So breaking down the sectors, very generally, there's a service out there called Smith Travel Research, STR, which is currently owned by CoStar. They purchased them a couple of years ago for an insane multiple for about $450 million. And STR really is sort of the really well-known and respected sort of data provider in the industry from a historical perspective. And they define the hotel world in different sort of scales. And usually it's determined based upon average rate. So you have the luxury scale, and I'll go into that in a moment, upscale, and then you have the upper mid-scale and economy. But within those, there are different sort of striations even within each one of those sectors. So within the luxury sphere, think things like Ritz Reserve, Aman, Mandarin Oriental, St. Regis, Ritz-Carlton, and many other, Waldorf Astoria, brands like that. And of course, there are many in the Four Seasons, of course, and there are many brands or hotels that, of course, fall into the luxury category, but are independent and not affiliated. And as we all know, even within that luxury sector, you know, you can have a Ritz-Carlton in any given market doing a $500 average rate, but Ritz Reserves do over 1,000. And Aman's generally do over 1,500 on average. And so, you know, again, even within luxury, there are different categories of luxury. Within upper upscale, think, you know, full service, food and beverage operations, meeting space, good quality hotels such as a Westin, such as a full service Hilton, full service Marriott, a Hyatt, an Intercontinental Hotel Group, those typically fall in somewhere between upper upscale and luxury. And then for frame of reference, the upscale is generally a lot of different select serve hotels. So select service could be considered an AC by Marriott, a Courtyard, a Hilton Garden Inn, a Hyatt Place. And then there's the mid-scale, which is typically, you know, limited or upper mid-scale rather, which, you know, would be considered maybe like a Hampton Inn, a Fairfield Inn, a Holiday Inn Express. And then you have the mid-scale, which is like a Comfort Suites, Best Western, those types of brands. And you have the economy brands like Clarion and Knights Inn and Econo Lodge, and a lot of the Wyndham Days Inn, a lot of the Wyndham and Choice brands fall in within economy. But then there's an interesting sort of even further striation, as I was saying, you know, within there is an extended stay, right, the category, if you will, which has actually done quite well during COVID, which I'm sure we'll talk about, you know. And then there's an upper upscale extended stay, think Residence Inn, Homewood Suites, Hyatt House. Then you have sort of the next level down of sort of in the upper mid-scale to upscale sector within extended stay. You've got Home2s, you got Town Places, And then, of course, there's the economy extended stays, such as Woodspring Suites by Choice, In-Town Suites. And so there's all the Suburban by Choice. You know, there's all these different categories within categories within categories, some of them determined by average rate, and some of them determined by sort of level of service in the hotel sector. You know, there's sort of full service, limited service, and then no service, if you will. So it really depends on how you want to define the hotel sector.
Right, and where it needed by, you know, which markets they are in. And that was a great breakdown. Thank you so much. You know what? You have different sizes of hotels. You have different types of hotels. Everything is nice. For those who want to get into the business or those who are already in the business, okay, and are looking into acquisitions and to acquire, especially in today's environment, because we've seen what happened in COVID. You know, when you take a pro forma, when you look into the underwriting of a hotel deal, you look into a certain type of occupancy in a low, how do you say, worst case scenario, let's say 30%, right? 25%, worst case scenario, who expected a zero? How can you actually fulfill the debt service? And that's what we went through. And everything now is coming back in a way. And if you could walk us through what's going on today and what type of opportunities are there and for who, and you know, what can we find out there?
So that's a loaded question. You asked about 19 questions in there.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm just so excited. Nice, I just throw everything, you know, the mud.
I'm happy to absorb it all. It's great. So what's happening today? What's happening today is, by and large, the sector is getting better. I wouldn't say it's fully recovered. Most prognosticators and our sort of partner firm, LORC, is projecting a recovery to 2019, called pre-COVID levels, by, you know, the second half of 22. And some are still projecting first half of 23. In fact, many prognosticators in the sector, you know, whether it's PwC or STR, CBRE, all these folks, a lot of them have moved up their projections, meaning they thought we wouldn't recover until maybe 23 or 24. And now they're moving them into really, for the most part, second half of 22 into the first quarter or first half of 23. So things are getting better. And generally speaking, they're getting better in a more positive fashion than originally expected. I think the interesting thing with this particular downturn is that it wasn't economically driven. It was health and safety driven. Right. So normally, you know, you see hotels, they lower their rates when it's economically driven, whether they should or they shouldn't from a theoretical perspective, which they should not. I can't blame them, right? We can't say, hey, don't lower your rates and just allow your hotels to be vacant until people are ready to return. Because if it's an economic situation, if you think about it, someone who's normally willing to pay $1,000 a night for a Four Seasons and now is a little bit skeptical in their job, say, hey, by the way, I give you the Four Seasons for $400. They'll say, you know what, maybe it's worth a trip to spend $400 for $1,000 value. Whereas now, this really wasn't an issue pertaining to the economy. People that have good jobs and had good jobs, generally speaking, and of course there are exceptions, still have their good jobs. The wealthier still wealthy, if not getting wealthier. And even I'll call it the upper middle to upper class folks, I'll call it high earners, not necessarily wealthy or rich people, they also tend to have weathered the storm fairly well, especially at this point, right? If maybe they lost their job and now they regain the job, maybe it's even better. There are certain sectors where they just can't find people, right? There are 10 million jobs and there are only like 6 million unemployed or something crazy like that, right? So, you know, it's definitely a situation that we're dealing with. So situations the hotels are dealing with also is labor. No different than the supply chain and all these other things. There's been a massive labor shortage in the hotel space. Some of it due to lower wages and some of it due to folks just not wanting to deal with hotels anymore and actually leaving the sector in favor of other sectors such as healthcare or Amazon or, you know, things of that ilk that may pay better and or may have better hours and they may be treated better. So we have that issue still arising. And frankly, it's still somewhat of an issue right now on the labor side. The costs of operating hotels have gone up dramatically. The supply chain, the increase in raw materials to build hotels as well as to just operate hotels. Everything from tech to food to paper goods, linens, etc. Costs have gone up somewhere between, depending on the hotel, depending on exactly what they need, 10 and 30, even 40%. I was in a local restaurant today and there was a sign that their costs have gone up somewhere between 30 and 100% on many items, which is insane.
Crazy.
Yeah, crazy. So that's sort of some of the challenges on the hotel side. We can spend a whole hour on that. But in terms of hotels that have sort of done fairly well, it's actually been rather interesting. I'll call it the economy extended, the extended stay sector in general has done quite well. And the economy extended stay sector, again, think WoodSpring Suites, think InTown Suites, think Extended Stay Americas, have actually done quite well. And this is due to a few reasons. Number one, they were sort of there for folks that were on the front lines, you know, whether it was FEMA, insurance companies, or simply folks that were doctors and frontline, first line responders to be able to stay, let's say, during the week while they're working in the hospital, working wherever they're working, and then go home to their families on the weekend. This is especially in the early days. Nurses, there were contracts with nurses in places like New York, even through the summer of 20 and into the fall of 2020. So those hotels tended to do better because they had little kitchenettes and they were comfortable places for people to stay for longer periods of time. Additionally, as the, I'd say the sort of middle and lower term in terms of earnings in the country, you know, did lose jobs, especially service sector folks, whether it was truck drivers or you know, retail employees, etc. You know, they lost jobs and they couldn't necessarily afford their apartments. So these particular properties became some level of workforce housing. If you think about it, you go to an apartment, you need your first month, you need last month, you need all these different things. You got it. Now you have to also have to pay for cable and internet and all this stuff. You walk into a decent quality extended stay hotel. You could be paying, especially in the middle of America, somewhere between $200 and $250 a week, call it $800 to $1,000 a month. There's no credit checks. There's no first and last. You pay by the week when you can afford it, and everything's included, right? Heat, AC, et cetera. So they became some, so they did really well.
Class, interesting family in a way. Yeah.
Yeah, it absolutely. And they could also rent their rooms transient from a transient basis. The other types of hotels that did super well were luxury hotels. Obviously, once they reopened, most hotels, frankly, closed between March and May, June of last year of 2020. When they reopened in June, July, there was this massive pent-up demand to travel. People hadn't seen people. They wanted to be outside. They wanted to feel in a secure environment, and they also wanted to feel spaced out. Where do you get that? You don't get that in a typical select service hotel like a Courtyard or a Residence Inn necessarily, but you certainly or a Hilton Garden Inn, but you do get it at an Aman resort. Yes. You do get it at a Four Seasons. Yes. And so those luxury hotels, starting in the summer of 2020 through today, are performing exorbitantly well. Let's also not forget that international travel stopped coming in, but also folks US folks stopped traveling internationally, right? So you have all these high earners who normally take their jets or fly first class and go to the Amalfi Coast or Cannes or St. Moritz or London or wherever it may be, or Hong Kong, right? They're not going anywhere. So they're still wealthy. They're still earning a lot of money in tech or finance or whatever it may be. Where do you go? So the hotels on the coast, California coast, the East Coast, they started seeing particularly the state of Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, et cetera. Well, Tennessee's not on the coast, but certainly has some nice resorts. You started seeing sort of
places, also places that are open, right?
Well, that's a whole nother category of sort of, you know, kind of blue versus red state, not to be political, but just to be matter of fact, right? Texas, Tennessee, Florida, the Gulf Coast, they opened up much sooner than other areas. And there was a sort of booking safety, not health safety, but a booking safety thing, knowing that hotels in Florida weren't just going to close on a whim because of some dictate put forth by a local state or city government. Right? So people could book with confidence that they were going to be able to stay there. Places like Puerto Rico have done extraordinarily well. And the luxury in Puerto Rico has done exorbitantly well because it was open and it was US and you could fly there with just a driver's license and some testing maybe, but that's fine. And so, you know, we saw sort of an uptick both on the economy extended stay side, as well as on the upside, on the luxury side. And now we're also seeing a tremendous renaissance overall, frankly, in values. The values of hotels, you ask, you know, what would I buy today? I'm not sure if there's a whole lot I would buy today. Obviously, there are certain sectors that I think are smart to go into and that are still have runway ahead of them. But the truth of the matter is that we've seen a massive increase in value in just the last 6 months to 12 months due to many different factors. I'll get into those in 1 second. And the reason that we what we've seen is that we've basically, what I've sort of termed, and obviously there are exceptions to everything, but by and large, we've seen values return to 2018, 2019, or even exceed those values in many cases. And at the same time, we're looking in many of these markets that EBITDA won't return to 19 for another 12 to even 24 months from now. So it's a really interesting dichotomy to see values returning a full year or more before EBITDA returns. or RevPAR even for that matter. And the reason for that is...
And why? I was about to ask you.
Yeah, so there's several reasons. Optimism amongst them, right? No different than the market going crazy until Friday, of course. But the market, right? Number one, capital markets. Lending returned to hospitality much quicker than most people thought. And lending rates, while they're still a little bit wider than they were in 2019, for the most part, are close to 2019. So borrowing is relatively inexpensive. And on top of that, it's plentiful. In other words, you go out there with a good solid AC by Marriott, Hilton Garden Inn, Tempo, Hyatt Place type of deal, you're going to get 30, 40 lender quotes, 10 term sheets, and you'll be able to have the pick of the litter. LTVs and LTCs, there is new construction, we're doing feasibility work. LTVs and LTCs are in the range of 2018-19 pre-COVID, call it 60 to 70%, maybe even up to 75 with additional mezzanine type leverage.
Wow.
Yeah. And the rates are somewhat equivalent. So the capital markets return very quickly, and there's tremendous competition within that market. And as you know, better than I probably, treasuries and SOFR rates and borrowing rates are exorbitantly low. And that applies to the hospitality sector as well. The other side of the coin is that from a risk-adjusted return perspective, before I get into that, the other aspect is inflationary hedge. Most folks perceive hotels to be an inflationary hedge because no different than we don't have long-term leases or credit tenancy. We are able to lease our guest rooms on a day-to-day basis. We can also reprice guest rooms on a second-by-second basis. And because of that, folks believe that there is an ability that in an inflationary environment, which we are clearly in today, that you can reprice the guest room. Yep. However, by the way, there is some research out there that Lark has published that indicates that is not necessarily the case. Going back to the other point I was going to make a moment ago as to why pricing has returned, it's also from a risk-adjusted returns perspective, better than most other real estate classes. So let's think about it for a second. Multifamily industrial trading at what? Threes and fours on the cap rate side, right?
Right. Office, depends where. Yeah, but yeah.
Right, exactly. Office, giant question mark, right? We don't know if office, what does a return to office look like in the long term?
Unknown.
Huge question mark. I'm not saying good or bad. I'm not an office guy, but I can tell you it's a huge question mark, right?
Nobody knows. I talked to a lot of people. So, nobody knows.
Right, so tough to invest in that, especially from an institutional perspective. Then you look at retail. Retail was kind of screwed pre-COVID. It certainly doesn't look much better today. And you'll say, oh, there's a luxury retail sector here. Sure, of course, there are shopping centers and there are power centers and there are malls that are doing phenomenally well. But retail as a sector, as an investment sector as a real estate asset class, was impaired pre-COVID. And it certainly is not any better today than it was then. So if you think about it, if multis and industrials are trading at such low cap rates, if you slap 200-300 basis points on that as a risk-adjusted return, and on a levered basis, even more than that, you're looking at something that a lot of folks that otherwise didn't want to enter the hotel real estate asset class are saying, hey, where can I get yield? Because I can't get it in multi, I can't get industrial, and the other asset classes in real estate, by and large, other than maybe self-storage, which is also super low yields, you know, they look exorbitantly risky. So I may as well take the risk on hotels, which seem to be returning. They're already positive cash flow. In most cases, hotels are actually positive NOI, and in many cases, already able to pay their debt even. Why not buy into that story? Additionally, the third primary factor, maybe the fourth primary factor, if you will, if including inflation, is that there was a ton of equity capital raised and sitting on the sidelines for distressed hotel deals. The distressed hotel deals never really materialized. So, you know, as it is in the private equity sector or in many sectors, other than maybe family offices, if you raise capital, there's one thing you need to do with it. You need to put it out. It's kind of a use it or lose it, right? And what better place to put it than hotels, which is, again, that risk-adjusted return perspective. So because you had all this equity capital raised on the thesis of hotels, they still want to invest in hotels, and they're still sort of making a case for it,
mentioned those with the deep pockets, you know, the family offices, all those who are going out there and buying, what is the most, I would say, desirable? What are they bullish on? What's the most desirable type of hospitality that they were going to go after?
For the family offices specifically, or private equity, or what?
It doesn't matter. Everyone who's out there and who's
looking. I think it really depends. Yeah, I think it depends. You know, right now, there's a $1 billion+ portfolio on the market that's all economy extended stay, right? And for a certain buyer that seeks cash flow, has no ego, and wants growth and can see the upside of this in the future and a great sort of in-place direct return, this is the type of, you know, you can get a, whatever, let's say an 8 or a 9 or a 10 plus on this, right? So this is the, this is where you go. A lot of buyers in the hotel space have operating platforms, management companies. I won't name them. We don't like to talk about specific names, but they have operating platforms. And frankly, they are being motivated by both the real estate as well as increasing fees to their management companies. Okay. So there's a significant opportunity to buy large, you know, 100 property portfolios, regardless of what they are, whether they're select service, economy, or even higher end, and then roll those properties into their management companies. There are others out there right now, such as like the large REITs, for instance. They want high quality real estate in high quality locations that are quote unquote irreplaceable or difficult, high barrier to entry. So they're willing to spend over $1 million or even over $2 million a key. We've seen more $1 million per key trades this year than all of history in the United States combined. Think about that for a moment.
Crazy.
So it's an incredible thing.
Can you dig into that? That's very exciting.
So early on in the pandemic, actually, the Four Seasons Orlando traded for about $1.4 million a key to host hotels.
What was the total price?
I do the math real quick. Yeah, it was about $650-ish million, $640 million, right? Wow. Around that number. Crazy. Big number, right? A few months later, Host bought another hotel in South Florida, this time in Key Largo area, $1 million a key for a Curio Collection hotel, $200 million total deal on that. The Alila, which is a Hyatt-branded five-star plus luxury property in also known as Ventana in Big Sur, sold for $2.5 million a key. So, and then sold again, actually, from Hyatt purchased it, and they sold it again to Host hotels for $2.54 million a key. So there's some incredible trades that are happening out there right now. There's also been significantly large trades. For instance, the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas is currently under contract for sale. Blackstone's the owner. They're selling it for $5.7 billion a key. By the way, they bought this for $1.7 billion about 8 or 9 years ago. So within an 8 to 10 year period, they turned a $4 billion profit. I believe. Don't quote me on this. But we are, because we're being recorded. I believe it's their largest dollar profit on a single asset in Blackstone history. Now think about that. That's saying a lot. We're not talking about me and you. Yeah. No offense, but we're talking about Blackstone here. So it's a pretty it's been a pretty incredible year from a transactional perspective. And think about that. That's a huge transaction. And by the way, we've seen many large transactions in Las Vegas, right? This year, and that was actually separated between OpCo and a PropCo, $4 billion for the land, $1.65 billion for the leasehold. MGM bought the leasehold, family office, and BRE actually stayed in the land and another company. But you know, you're seeing tremendous faith in Las Vegas. What is that? Leisure dollars and corporate group and convention dollars, right? So you have faith in both of the return of both of those major sectors. It's been interesting in this particular cycle to see how the recovery has been shaped. You know, I actually said early on, not to give myself a pat on the back, but I actually said early on, I think that we'll see leisure recover first, which we saw. That was fairly obvious to most people. But I also said, I think we're going to see a return of group travel, both corporate and leisure, before we see a corporate transient return. Because people desired to get together, people wanted to get to conventions, people wanted to network and wanted to see each other. And on the corporate transient side, Zoom has been somewhat of an impact. Long-term, I have no idea, no different than the office sector, how much of an impact it will be. I don't think it'll be massive, but it will be an impact, you know, on folks not necessarily having to travel as much as they did. Although I don't think that applies to me, because I feel like I've been traveling just as much, if not more. So, you know, again, the sector, it's been a very interesting and sort of uneven recovery within the hotel sector.
Tell me something. If someone wants to go in today, and he wants to do the underwriting for a property, for a hotel. He wants to get IRS. Are they going to look differently at the RevPAR, ADR, occupancy than they looked at it before COVID?
Yeah. So it is highly dependent on location, highly dependent on the asset, the CapEx necessary. CapEx is a huge component of buying and selling hotels and also operating hotels, which is doesn't exist in most other forms of real estate, especially as intensively and as big of dollars as they do in hospitality. Depends on the location, depends on the orientation of the hotel. Is it for leisure? Is it group? Is it corporate? And I would say generally when we underwrite hotels today, it's weird because the last 2 years are somewhat irrelevant, meaning 2020 and 2021 were both these sort of, you know, off odd years. In some markets, like maybe South Florida or certain resort destinations, the end of 20 and all of 21 have been 40, 50% ahead of pre-COVID. And then the question is, or did we set a new benchmark, or will they sort of moderate downward back to a level of normalcy that they were achieving pre-COVID, right? That's the first question. And so in underwriting, you really have to understand, what did 20 and 21 do to your market and your specific asset? Did you do better? Did you do worse? And then you have to say, okay, is there a new benchmark set to the high end or the low end? And or when are we getting back to 19 and then continuing on from there? In most cases, we're looking at, you know, sort of the last stable year, which is say 19, right? But and sort of saying we will get back to 19 by 22, 23, whatever that term is. Now, by the way, we have to be careful of cost increases, because even if RevPAR and revenue get back to 19, that doesn't necessarily indicate that we'll be back to 19 from a profitability perspective, given the cost of raw materials, goods, and of course, labor, right? So costs overall have increased. So is there an impact to the bottom line there? It depends also. It's sort of an interesting question to ask. So again, you know, it's really an asset by asset, market by market, segment by segment, but by and large, you're looking as to when you'll get back to 19 on the underwriting side. I will tell you though, there are certain, I'll call weird markets out there that are difficult to project even today, because if you look at a market, let's say like Puerto Rico, right? So 20 and 21 were exorbitantly good. 21 was exorbitantly good, and the end of 20 was exorbitantly good because, again, it was open, a lot of nicer properties there, et cetera. And it was a great Caribbean style destination for folks to go to that couldn't go to the, you know, to let's say the BVI or other types of other countries, islands. However, Puerto Rico really hasn't had a stabilized year since God knows when, because 19 was a recovery from the hurricanes in 18, and there's a hurricane in 17. You had Zika in 16, 17. You had another something happen in the market in 15. So you really almost haven't had a stabilized year since like 14 or 15. So, you know, again, that's what we say, really, is market by market. And you really have to understand your locality and your asset in terms of understanding how to underwrite that property going forward. In other words, what are you trying to get back to, or where are you going, or where are we moderating to? So,
right. You know what you said before, it's very fascinating. You spoke about all the banks, the financiers that are coming in with up to 75% LTC, LTV. And that's really, really interesting, because, you know, there were the source of scarcity, right? They were like the ones who were so afraid of what's going to happen, what are we going to do? And, you know, every landlord, doesn't matter which asset class they had to go and discuss it with their, with any banks that they had to deal with. But right now, you would have expect, with valuations going skyrocketing, but at the same time, the market is not yet back, even though it's exciting, even though it's not yet there, meaning obviously there's the argument, like you said in the beginning, 2023, 2022, the middle, the end, whatever it is, wherever it is. Why are the banks giving such type of, you know, of loans, such type of financing? Why is that happening? What's the finance, the capital psychology behind it?
So I can't tell you what they're thinking. I can tell you the conversations that we've had and the discussions. First and foremost, let's remember something, right? Compensation drives behavior, and compensation is a massive motivation. So candidly speaking, and I'm not speaking about any specific lender, if lenders don't lend money, they also don't have jobs. They also don't make their bonuses, and they also don't make any money. That's number one.
Great point.
It's number one, right? Let's be honest about it, right? No different than capital allocators putting capital out. The second part of it is that, by and large, and again, everybody knows an asset that was lost to the bank, and everybody knows a lender that took a hit. But by and large, the banks did not get hit that badly. CMBS 2.0 and the underwriting that took place between the Great Recession in 2011 and that sort of that 10-year period, there really wasn't a major loss from COVID because the banks were able, similar to the Great Recession, a lot of them extended and pretended. There were a lot of federal mandates that were put in place to keep the banks from being from going after lenders. And by the time the banks were sort of ready to execute, number one, you know, you think about it, again, because this wasn't an economic recession, people were willing to travel fairly quickly. Maybe not on the corporate transient side, but on the other, on the corporate group, social group, and social leisure side, on the leisure side. And so we saw that fairly quickly they started making money again. Also, hotels were able to cut expenses dramatically. You know, hotels that had 20 full-time equivalent employees, you know, were able to operate with 6 and 7 and therefore starting to make money sooner. But also I think that they just simply saw that they didn't really lose a lot of money, and the underwriting that they did last cycle worked. And those 60 to 70% LTVs and LTCs for the most part worked. And even the folks that are in CMBS, they've already seen their values recover. And so even though some borrowers will be hurt and have been hurt and will continue to be hurt, and frankly, there may be a bit of a push of deluge, quasi-deluge of assets that hit the market in the next 6 to 12 months because the CMBS providers and the lenders are finally coming and saying to the borrowers, hey, it's time to either pay up or get a rescue capital or we're going to take your assets, right? So that still may happen. But even in those cases, for the most part, the lenders, the special servicers, et cetera, are really not taking hits to value. Again, by and large, for the most part. And so the lenders didn't get hurt that badly. They need to put money out to make money. The market is extremely competitive and values are continuing to sort of buttress the underlying collateral of the loans that they do still hold on their books and of the loans that they're looking to make. And so, you know, you think about it, there really isn't nearly as much risk to them as there are obviously on the equity side, because always, right? They're sort of the last loss position. So they're going in at 65 cents on the dollar. And by the way, maybe that dollar is still lower than it was pre-COVID. So they're going in at, you know, call it 60 or 65 cents or even 50 cents, whatever that may be on the dollar. That's still less than pre-COVID. It's looking pretty good, especially given where the recovery is shaping. Now we've got this new Omicron or whatever the heck it's called, variant. But as long as we're not hysterical about it, and we actually follow the data on it and the science on it, I'm hopeful and prayerful that there will be there will not really be much of a blip in the recovery cycle. And so I think that's what lenders are seeing as well. And they're seeing that relative strength and desire on both sides of the ledger.
That's great perspective. Tell me something. You know, every market is driven by transaction, right? Every market is driven by transaction. And we spoke about those who are buying, but we didn't speak about those who are selling.
Yeah.
And that's meaning who is driven to sell today? What type of sellers do you have there today? Because if the big guys, the corporates, the REITs, the family offices, the deep pockets are coming and buying, who's selling?
Yeah, so private equity is always recycling capital, right? So private equity in many cases is taking the opportunity to sell at all-time high pricing, or certainly pre-COVID pricing, right? They've held an asset, maybe they had to hold it for an extra 2 years in their fund cycle. Now is the time to sell it and sort of, you know, hit their return levels and return promotes, et cetera. That's private equity, generally speaking. Hedge funds, similar sort of trajectory to that. I think also, you know, you're looking at a lot of large private equity owners, like call it a, you know, Blackstone is on the buy side and on the sell side, right? Blackstone's selling Cosmo. They bought the land under the Cosmo back. And they're also, they're selling a number of different portfolios, but they also just bought Extend and Stay America along with Starwood Capital and 585 hotels along with that brand, right? Brookfield right now has a portfolio, you know, that they're thinking about financing or selling, but Brookfield also just went into contract to sell the Diplomat down in Hollywood, Florida. Hollywood Beach, Florida, for, you know, $850 million, which is actually a larger number than they were getting pre-COVID. And it's being purchased. Who's buying it? Jeffrey Sofer with Fountain Blue Development, right? They're owners of large, significant, irreplaceable assets on the beach and in other areas in Miami, and they know the market really well. So for them, it's accretive. And for Brookfield, it's an opportunity to monetize an asset that they created a lot of value in, right? So I think you have sort of the turnover in cash. I think you're seeing these sort of outsized pricing You know, for instance, the folks down at the Four Seasons Orlando, they had held that, they developed that asset, held it for 10 years. It was a private equity firm and a private development company from New York. And, you know, they said, hey, this is a great time to monetize our asset. They sold at an all-time price per key for Orlando, more than double the next highest price per key in Orlando history. So again, if you're getting pricing like that, why would you not sell? You know, we've also seen purchases by the REITs. We've also seen a lot of family offices sort of monetized. You know, Newcrest Image owned, I believe, 22 or 27 assets. They just sold them to Summit Hotels, 27 assets, I believe, for $822 million. We've seen a lot of sales of operating platforms as well, because the larger operating platforms in the hotel space, the management, third-party management platforms, are continuing to get larger. And so you're seeing a lot of the smaller folks combine. We saw Pyramid and Benchmark combine. We saw Paramount and PM, Buccini Poland's management group combine. You know, so we've seen, you know, Hotel Equities has been a pretty significant buyer of management platforms. Highgate and Ambridge, obviously, you know, the sort of two large gorillas in that room. So again, we're seeing sort of sales of platforms in an opportunistic way, in sort of a protective way. And then we're seeing sales of assets that are either, you know, either fund life or driven by taking capital off the table and or recycling capital. So it's really a number of different reasons. And with asset pricing where it is, it's a really good time to sell.
Tell me something, with so many transactions going on, is there any development also? I'm sure there is, but what's the volume?
I would say there is. I would say that most of the development, as it has been for the last several years, is taking place in the select service space. You know, again, sort of that upscale to mid-scale range. You know, a lot of extended stay being developed. A lot of you know, AC by Marriott's and Hilton Garden Inns and Tempos and Hyatt Centrics and Captions and all these different types of brands that are sort of in that select service space. They're still on balance relatively inexpensive to build in comparison to, let's say, a full service hotel. If a full service hotel in a good suburban market costs $350,000 a key to build, these hotels are generally plus or minus $200,000 a key to build, and generally the RevPAR is around the same, and you don't have the risk of food and beverage. And you also have a lower employee count. So yeah, I would say that we're doing feasibilities of interesting assets a lot, especially like in New York area and the Hudson Valley, Napa, places like that. You're seeing a lot of interesting properties getting developed. And then we're seeing a lot in that middle zone continuing to get developed. So yeah, and like I said, I would say construction financing is more challenging to find than it was a couple of years ago pre-COVID, but it's not impossible.
Tell me something. With talking about all that stuff, it leads me to I'm very curious, and I want to educate the people who want to get into this hospitality sector, and they have the ability to get in, and they want to get into those acquisitions. Firm like yourself, how do you guys help those who want to go and acquire a hotel throughout the process? Meaning, obviously, there's a whole process for it. If you could, I know you could go through it for like 2 days or, you know, straight now. But if you could like shrink it down for like, let's say, a 3-4 minute type of a process to make it crisp and understood that it's doable.
Absolutely. Thanks, Yishai. So this is the opportunity for the free commercial. Thank you. So step one is a market study. You know, our valuation group will provide a market study. Say, you know, you say, hey, Yishai, you come over and say, hey, Evan, I want to build a hotel in Brooklyn. And I'll say, okay, where? Let's go see the site. Let's first determine if the zoning allows for it. Let's determine different things like topography and taxes, and can the site handle it? Great. Then we'll do a market study. We'll help you figure out what kind of average rates and occupancies and things like that you can achieve here, and what kind of cash flow you can achieve. And then you'll say, okay, well, here's what I think it's going to cost to build based on my experience as an experienced developer. We'll take you through that process. We'll produce a feasibility study based on our market study and your cost structure, and we'll combine them together. We'll come up with essentially an IRR. You'll say, okay, you know, I'm developing to a 37 IRR. This makes sense for me. Great. Let's, what do I do next? And we'll say, okay, well, now we're going to run a process to help you find a brand. We're going to run a process, an RFP process, to help you find a management company. We're going to bring those folks on board, and then we're going to help you through the development process and essentially be sort of your de facto hotel partner throughout the entire development process. You're a developer, we have the brand, we have the management company, and we're assisting you, helping make sure that you do the right things from a property management system, from OS&E, FF&E, you're buying right, you're making the right deals. And then once it's open, once the hotel's open and operating, and call it somewhere between 24 and 48 months, depending on the municipality, right? we can then third-party asset manage it. Because you'll say, hey, listen, I'm a real estate guy. I'm not a hotel guy. And I've got these management guys in there and they seem great, but I really want someone to watch over them and make sure that every dollar that comes in or out of there and someone's focused on it like it's my, like it's their dollar. And that's what we do. We come in as a third-party asset manager. So we're able to sort of take you from cradle through disposition and really help you every step of the way by analyzing it, by doing due diligence, by doing the underwriting, by sort of doing the nitty-gritty details and then helping you with contracts and securing of management branding and even furniture along the way. That's we are sort of a full service comprehensive shop within that sector.
Sounds great. And tell me, if you could tell everybody who's listening, you guys can see obviously the links below and above. If you could tell everybody how they can find you guys and use your services.
Thank you, Shai. Absolutely. Feel free to visit our website, www.lwhospitalityadvisors.com. My email's on there. My LinkedIn's on there. I'm pretty active posting on LinkedIn. I encourage you to follow me, Evan Weiss on LinkedIn, which I think is how you should actually found me. I love posting things that are interesting to me, that are timely to me, whether it's about real estate or specifically hospitality or about markets that I really like. So Evan.Weiss, Evan.Weiss at lwhadvisors.com. And I look forward to connecting with many of you.
Evan, thank you so much for being with us. That was great. And I know we could go for another 2 hours from the pace that you're going, a great New York pace, as we call. It was really fun. It was really fun. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Check out all those links. Follow Evan. I love his post on LinkedIn. Go see what he writes about hospitality. You guys can educate yourself within that. And Evan, thank you so much for being with us. You guys take care of yourselves. Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.